Hello, it's Tom here. Before we get into this episode of Last Orders, I just want to let you all know about a very exciting new development for our podcast roster over here at Spiked. So the Spiked podcast, that's our weekly Spiked show with myself, Ella Whelan and Fraser Myers, is now being filmed every week. So if you prefer to watch rather than just listen to your podcast, you can catch new episodes of the Spiked podcast every Friday on YouTube. To see our most recent episode discussing the moral panic over racism in football and much more besides, head over to the Spiked YouTube channel and be sure to subscribe. Thanks so much, and now back to Last Orders. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show all about freedom, the nanny state, censorship, and for a while longer yet, it seems, COVID. Today we discuss Freedom Day, sugar taxes and prescription cabbages, and cancel culture in comedy. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor at Spiked. I'm joined today, as I am every month, by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Hi, Tom. I'm sweltering.
Yeah, listeners won't be able to see, but Chris is in quite a remarkable state of undress on this podcast call at the moment. But
it's the hottest day of the year.
It is, to be fair. So today we're delighted to be joined by a very special guest who is Leo Kirst. Leo is a brilliant comedian. I was lucky enough to see him a couple of times before the plague era, when we were still allowed to go to comedy clubs and all the rest of it. And he's also recently contributed to an IEA book all on the subject of free speech with his contribution talking about cancel culture in comedy, which we'll discuss a little bit later. But Leo, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start off by talking about Freedom Day, which I think it's fair to say feels quite damp. It's probably got something to do with the fact that still hundreds of thousands of people self-isolating at home. So it's probably a bit of a weird kind of freedom for them. But also the mood music from government has been very cautious. A lot of the restrictions have come out of law, but you're seeing transport networks enforcing masking. And in the last 24 hours, we've seen the government come out and wave the threat of vaccine passports again, this specifically in relation to clubs. So it's Freedom Day in a sense, but doesn't feel like it necessarily. But just to kick things off, Chris, how free are you feeling after Monday's unlocking?
I'm pretty free. I've felt pretty free since May the 17th, to be honest, because I don't have that many friends and I don't do that many things. So long as my snooker club is open, that was really sufficient for me. I'm pleased people can go clubbing again. Obviously, I won't be joining them, but it was good to see them all cracking on a Monday night. I suppose the dampeners were put on it when Boris suddenly announced that he was going to maybe look at vaccine passports for clubs and gatherings. But this strikes me as a fairly obvious bluff to try and get young people to, you know, get their vaccines, because Macron did the same thing a few days earlier. And that has done the trick. I suppose in France, it's quite a credible threat. I don't know if it's quite so credible here, but I'd be very surprised if he does it. I don't honestly think the government has the competence to run a vaccine passport scheme in clubs. I really don't. I don't think they've got enough time to put it together. So I think that's a big bluff. But it was a bit of a downer. And, of course, you had all the people going like, oh, we told you so. We're going to be locked down forever, all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, that was a bit annoying. But you know, I'm glad that they've taken the plunge, because it's a fairly brave thing to do when you've got 50,000 recorded cases a day, you know, nearly back to January levels. But, you know, as we, I think, said before, you know, it's looking all right on the hospital front, looking very good on the mortality front. So, yeah, I'm pleased that it's got that far. I hope people now sort of get out there, enjoy it. I also hope, of course, that they get rid of this stupid self-isolation thing, which is just becoming a farce, as you know, the government ministers and Boris Johnson themselves kind of proved over the weekend.
What about you, Leo? Are you as positive as Chris is about where we're headed at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a gradual process, but I mean, for the last few weeks, like the comedy clubs, not all the comedy clubs, but like Top Secret and Covent Garden have been open with a reduced capacity, with screens between the rows and stuff. But it still felt good. So I haven't really felt like, you know, I've been in a huge lockdown. And I don't think most people, I mean, like the people who came up with the rules, I haven't been following the rules. So I've been meeting friends, having dinner parties, all the rest of it. I'm exempt from wearing a mask, because if you say you're exempt, you're exempt. So I don't need to wear a mask. In fact, a policeman stopped me. This is a true story. A policeman stopped me at Euston Station and said, where's your mask? And I said, I'm exempt. But I thought, I better have an excuse. I said, they give me anxiety. And he's like, where's your lanyard? Saying they give you anxiety. And I was like, lanyards give me anxiety as well. but, I mean, for the government to announce this sort of Freedom Day, they were already making noises weeks before that it wasn't going to be absolute freedom. We've still got, you know, you need to quarantine if you go on holiday, you need PCR tests. There's so much doublespeak with this government. And with woke culture, I mean, we know nowadays when somebody says inclusivity or inclusion, they mean excluding straight white men. Like, we know that that's what that means, you know what I mean? It's not like they're trying to include... I've never seen an HR department inclusion program to get more Brexit voters into, you know, represented in something. And oppression, you know, if somebody's oppressed, it means they're actually the most powerful in the top of the victim pyramid. So I knew freedom wasn't going to mean freedom. It was going to mean... it's going to mean something else. And in this case, it means mandatory IDs to go to a nightclub, as if going to a nightclub wasn't awful enough already.
And Chris, you touched on it there as well, but this, the double speak and the mixed messages. I mean, vaccine passports have been ruled out and ruled in about 400 times at this point. You know, you had the Deem Zahawi went on record saying, we're not going to do this. And yet he got up in the House of Commons on Monday and said, we are prepared to do this. So whether or not it turns out to be a bluff, what do you make of this tendency to just deal in these kind of, you know, willfully misleading messages or sort of threats, really? I mean, that's surely not healthy, regardless if we don't end up with vaccine passports further down the road.
Yeah, it must be the nudge unit involved.
The behavioural insights team.
This is like the third time they've tried this bluff with the vaccine passports, at least the third time. They've done it from fairly early on when they were a bit concerned that they wouldn't get to, you know, very high vaccine uptakes. And then about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a front page splash on the Times, this sort of exclusive, didn't have any sources in it whatsoever, but it was vaccine passports are coming in for pubs or for something or other, you know. And it was obviously just an attempt to get the under 40s to get their vax. And this is just an attempt to get the under 30s to get their vax. Maybe I'm leaving yet another Snowden hostage to fortune on this. But, you know, because I've not always been right during this pandemic, I will hold my hands up. I have erred at times. But I, as I said, I will be very surprised if they bring it in. I think it's not just a bluff, but quite a tired old bluff now. And, yeah, you're right. They shouldn't be lying to the public to get them to do what they want to do. But, you know, it is, at the end of the day, a public health issue, and lying to the public to get them to change their behaviour is what public health is mainly about these days.
But Chris, stay with you for a second, because, you know, I know your philosophy has been that it will be fine, that all of these kind of concerns about restrictions being brought back in later on down the line are largely unfounded. But, you know, I mean, are you still sticking to that now, even with the vaccine passports thing, even with Boris Johnson saying very explicitly that, yes, we want this roadmap to be irreversible, but we can't rule out reversing it, was basically his message. And also, you know, there has been pretty explicit talk from Chris Whitty, et cetera, about the need for measures in this very vague, nebulous sense, could mean anything from something quite draconian to something pretty benign. You really think we're out of this now, I guess, is my question.
I pretty much do. I think when they talk about measures, I think there are some people in public health who quite like people to be wearing masks on public transport, particularly at winter anyway, you know? I think maybe that's what he's getting at. But I just don't see what is going to happen in the next few months that's going to require another lockdown. I mean, the number of infections you would have to get anywhere close to the number of hospitalizations and deaths we saw in January, they'll be so high that you'd run out of people to infect within about 10 days. You know, so I just don't see it happening. And also, it's becoming clear to me that we're not going to reach herd immunity through the vaccines, and that the vaccines are, you know, they're very good, but they're not that brilliant at preventing infection and transmission. And so it's just a matter of making sure people have mild symptoms, really. And it does that very well. But that does mean that ultimately lots and lots of people are going to get the virus over the next few months. And the government model, for what it's worth, says that there's going to be a big spike August and sort of dying down in September, because basically everyone who's going to get it has got it by then. So, I mean, what's going to happen in winter? I mean, aside from a completely different variant, I just don't see how we can be heading towards any kind of a problem in winter. I think we're just going to see some kind of super spreading events now, nightclubs, I'm quite sure, will be super spreader events. They have been in various parts of the world. But there's only so many super spreaders, you know, and there's lots of people who are still fairly reclusive who are never really going to get it. And it doesn't matter that much if they do. And I think Chris Whitty and all these people realize that. They've more or less been saying it for a long time. I kind of had in my mind the idea we'd get to herd immunity through the vaccines, but I don't think we will. You only have to look at somewhere like Gibraltar to see proof of that. Gibraltar's vaccination rate is over 100%. Over 100% of the people in Gibraltar have been vaccinated. How does that work? Well, it's because lots of people in Spain go working in Gibraltar. And they've still had this really big spike. And so has Malta, which have got more vaccines than us. Israel, obviously, done really well with the vaccines there, having a big spike. But, you know, c'est la vie. And, you know, the hospitals aren't filling up. This is the exit, you know?
And Leo, just on the kind of culture war aspect of this as well, because it feels like in the past 2 weeks in particular, the way in which kind of COVID and lockdowns got folded into the culture war has been much more explicit, quite a lot more, you know, funny as well. You know, just the response to the unlocking, people very ostentatiously talking about wearing their masks, this kind of US style battle over masks, this kind of stuff. What have you made of all of that? Why has it come through so late in the day almost?
I mean, well, I think right from the start, the mask was seen as a symbol of, like, you know, I am a left-wing wokist and I care about the community and I care about other people. And the opposite of that is not wearing a mask has been this sort of Trumpist libertarian, you know, I'll die on my feet rather than live on my knees with a mask on, you know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to watch. You know, I was terrified by the like, previously, even Boris, even the government believed that the British people would never accept lockdown restrictions. They said there'd be riots in the street. I mean, there have been a few riots, but they said, you know, British people would never accept it. We're the crucible of modern democracy and freedom and individual rights. And actually, what we found out is the British people absolutely love lockdown. They love having all their rights and liberty taken away from them. I think it is partly due to the fact that we still get paid for our jobs. I mean, I don't because I'm a comedian, but if you've got a regular job, you still got all your furlough money, but you don't need to go to work. You just sit in your dressing gown in your living room. You might turn on your laptop a bit and pretend to work. So it's been hugely popular with the British people. And for the last, like, you know, 20 years, the assumption has been that as China gets richer and gets this this sort of middle class intelligentsia, that it's naturally going to gravitate towards freedom and democracy, because that's what people want. And actually, what we've found is people would rather live in China. Like, give them the choice between the freedom. I mean, maybe it's just because they haven't seen the bad. They haven't experienced living under, you know, a sort of communist regime, a collectivist regime, that they don't realize it's so bad. But I'm really scared right now for the next, like, 10, 20 years. I think Western democracies are really going to start gravitating. I mean, you see it with the legislation that's coming through where our rights are being winnowed away. And, you know, we could really, you know, the social scoring and all this kind of stuff. I mean, the vaccine passports are sort of a step towards social scoring. So, yeah, I'm worried about freedom and democracy in the UK over the next 10, 20 years.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for the pro-freedom, anti-woke person in your life? Then look no further than the Spiked shop. You can now get your favourite Spiked slogan on a t-shirt, hoodie, tote bag or mug, including ban nothing, question everything, love Europe, hate the EU and cancel culture. Plus, if you're a Spiked supporter, you can get a 15% discount off of everything. Just go to spiked-online.com/shop to browse our items and make your purchases. That's spiked-online.com/shop. On that very solemn note, let's talk about a classic kind of mental nanny state story, which is the publishing of this national food strategy. So this is the work of the food czar. They're always czars these days. Henry Dimbleby is the co-founder of the kind of upmarket fast food chain Leon. And he's finally delivered his report. In it are calls for taxes on sugar and salt, some other eye-catching things, prescription vegetables, potentially. Go and get your cabbages from your GP, which is quite interesting. But Chris, do you want to tell us a bit more about the proposals that this report makes and what you make of all of it?
Yes. The main proposals that were in the media, at least, were the ideas of having a tax on sugar, like all sugar, and a tax on salt, even though there's no calories in salt, and it's going to be twice the tax on sugar. And also the free fruit and vegetables. I've done so many interviews about this, and I still like to talk about free fruit and vegetables prescribed by GPs, because vegetables are so expensive. You know, you've got to have them prescribed by GPs. So this are completely unaffordable to the poor, which is why, you know, it's been a staple diet of the world's poor for thousands of years. And I mean, there's two things that get me about Henry Dimbleby in this. The first is, yeah, he was sort of hired as a food czar to look at this issue. And it's not just obesity, it's the whole food, you know, the whole topic of food, climate change and environmentalism and everything. But he's supposed to look at it with a fresh pair of eyes and be an independent outside kind of voice, you know. And then when he comes back, his first chapter 2 years ago was let's ban junk food advertising, you know, like, which was such an orthodox view that the government had actually introduced legislation to do it by the time he published his report, and he was reduced to moaning about Percy Pigs being sold in Marks and Spencer. And then this new one is let's tax sugar and salt. You know, it's just the most boneheaded kind of stuff that anyone could say. And he's completely bought into this reformulation bullshit. So he was saying the same thing as what Mad Dog McGregor at Action on Sugar has been saying, which is, oh, it's not a tax on people. It's obviously normal people won't be paying this tax, because it's a tax on the industry, and the industry are going to take the sugar and the salt out of the food, and you won't pay anything. You'll just have healthier food. I mean, this is just the kind of thing. I mean, it's an idea that you'd expect from a small child, really. The idea that obesity is, you know, people are eating too much. So what we'll do, we'll take out the calories from the food. Magic, you know, Willy Wonka view of food manufacturing. So that's one thing that gets me about it. The other thing that gets me is this guy founded Leon Fast Food, right? Now, I don't go to Leon Fast Food very often. I've been once in Euston Station because I was struggling. The pasty shop must have been closed or something. I thought I'd give it a go. It's expensive. But what's really struck me is it is literally just junk food, right? But rebranded so you can charge twice as much to, you know, middle-class people at train stations. And if you look at the nutritional content of this stuff, it is as bad, if not worse, than you would expect from, you know, well-known American burger chains, right? Loads of salt, loads of fat, loads of sugar in the brownies and all the other kind of stuff. You've got popcorn sold at the checkout, chocolate bars. You know, nothing wrong with any of this stuff, obviously, as far as I'm concerned. But then I'm not a health fascist who's going around saying we should tax sugar and salt and give away fruit and veg in GP surgeries. So if Leon, and to be fair, he's no longer involved in running Leon, right? But I'm sure he's got some influence over his successors, and he could have done something about it when he was running the place. If Leon, which is a conspicuously and overtly healthy shop, supposedly, that's a whole USP, it's healthy fast food, if they can't take sugar and salt and fat and calories out of their burgers, what chances are of anybody else doing it? So the fact that this guy's been involved in the food industry, you would think would make him understand a bit more how food is made and why people buy it.
Leo, what do you make of all this?
Well, a tax on salt and sugar and fat could probably just completely wipe out Scotland's fiscal deficit. We won't need the Barnett formula anymore. But I mean, I'm not sure they've thought it through correctly, because certain foods are high fat or high sugar or high salt, but kind of healthy, like cheese, for example. I mean, I don't know if it's healthy, but it's delicious. And certainly if you're on a keto diet, if you're on the paleo diet, which is probably healthier than eating just basic processed carbohydrates, then you're going to be paying that tax, even though, you know, you're going to be eating a healthier diet than, you know, somebody's eating noodles. I think this guy, he runs Leon, which, you know, as you point out, is basically McDonald's for wankers. I mean, it's tasty. I go there, but I don't pretend it's healthy. I think the real problem with food in this country, I've seen it in Scotland. In Scotland, there's a real cultural aversion to salad and green food. People want processed food that they've seen an advert on TV, like raw food. Food that's actually from a vegetable or something real is seen as suspicious and dirty. So we need to change the culture, the way people think about food. It's a problem with ignorance rather than, you know, being financial or anything else. People have got access to vegetables. You can eat vegetables incredibly cheaply. Carrots are like amazingly cheap. Lentils are incredibly cheap. You don't have to be eating like asparagus tips. So you can eat incredibly incredibly well and incredibly healthily for very cheaply, much more cheaply than you'd buy, you know, a kebab with mayonnaise on it. So in school, instead of teaching people about gender pronouns and whatever else they teach them these days, teach them how to pay tax, how to fill in a tax return, how to fix a car, and how to like cook some broccoli.
It's interesting because the whole report was very much framed around how do we help poor and working class people, kind of recognizing again a lot of these issues with the fact that these measures will hit them disproportionately because they do eat these foods disproportionately, as it were. But it just always seems to be such a strange thing to focus on if you want to improve people's lot in life is what they eat. Yeah. I mean, this seems to get things slightly the wrong way around. I mean, it makes perfect sense that people who don't have a lot of time and don't have a lot of money, obviously vegetables are still cheap and readily available. But sometimes after, at the end of a long shift, you know, you've just got the kids back from school, you just want to give them something quick and tasty. That doesn't seem to me like a strange phenomenon. And yeah, yet it seems to be something that they obsess over.
It's convenience rather than speed, because you can open a packet of carrots and just eat the carrots. You can eat them right out of the bag, like a horse. You know, we can digest carrots.
This is all useful advice on this show as well. So if you want real fast food, get a bag of carrots. But Chris, I thought it was interesting that there seemed to be some recognition almost in the report that these measures were regressive. So there was this kind of attempt to ameliorate it slightly with kind of crumbs from the government table, like more free school meals, as well as this never going to happen prescription vegetable idea. But are they at least a bit on the defensive about the fact that all of these measures just always hammer ordinary people and don't really touch people who like to go and eat at Lyon because they can usually afford these things?
Yeah, it's obviously a big chink in the armour that, you know, you get people on both left and right saying, well, this is going to disproportionately hurt the poor, and it's kind of difficult to deny that. So they find new ways of denying it, basically. And taxes are generally pretty unpopular, but there's two things you can do to make tax popular. Firstly, make people think they're not going to pay it, hence all this rubbish about, oh, it's just going to be the industry pays it, and they'll just take out these toxic ingredients, you know. And the other thing is to make people think that the money that is raised is going to go to nice cuddly things. Now, tax hypothecation almost never happens in practice, and I can hardly think of any examples of it happening with food or drink taxes. A lot of the sugar taxes around the world, like the sugary drinks taxes, are sold on the basis that this money's going to go towards kindergarten, you know, classes, or it's going to go towards breakfast clubs in school. If you remember the sugar levy, our sugary drinks tax was meant to go on breakfast clubs and school sports, just like this thing is now. And it didn't. That was quietly dropped a year later. These things, it's such a trick. It's such a con, because they always bait you in with this idea that, oh, this money is going to go to something really good. And then it just disappears into the general fund. So, you know, it never happens like that. You're right that they are wary about, you know, the kind of regressive argument. Funnily enough, old Dimbleby, he mentions a meat tax in the report, and he says that it would be regressive and unpopular, so he's not proposing it. I don't know why he thinks a tax on salt and sugar wouldn't be regressive or unpopular. I suspect it would certainly be regressive, and I imagine it would be unpopular. I don't see this happening at all. We'll probably have a salt tax by Christmas. We'll be back in lockdown. But I don't see it happening. I mean, Boris more or less poured cold water of it straight away, didn't he? Say he doesn't want to tax hardworking people. And then whoever they are, actually, on sugar, National Obesity Forum or something, wrote to the Times saying, this is not a tax on people, it's a tax on industry. Yeah, and I don't think it's going to happen. It would be really unpopular. Salt taxes in particular have a really bad history. if you look them up on the internet, salt tax was partially responsible for the French Revolution and quite a few other revolutions and wars down the years. So I don't think he's going to be inclined to do it. But it's been interesting to see how many people have come out of the woodwork to support it. That's been quite fun.
And I think the current diet of the UK has to be framed in the context of history. And we've got compared to even like 60 years ago, we've got insanely cheap and widely available protein and vegetables and just the variety of food we can access. If you look at the price of an egg in real terms back in, you know, the 1920s was, I mean, I'm not sure what it is, but it's way more than it is now. We've made healthy food incredibly accessible. And if the government really cares about people not being fat and sedentary, why are they having a lockdown? Instead of having a lockdown, I mean, considering, like, getting fat makes you high risk for coronavirus, why don't we just, instead of like shutting the gyms, force people to go to the gyms, lock them in the gyms instead of locking them in their houses?
Don't give them ideas, for God's sake. I'd rather have a lockdown.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. Let's turn to our final topic, which is cancel culture in comedy. So, Leo, you've not only been a kind of target of said cancel culture in comedy yourself, but you've also contributed to this new IEA book called Having Your Say, Threats to Free Speech in the 21st Century. Whole load of contributors there looking at all of the different fronts in the fight for free speech. And your chapter touches on a very personal story, actually, of your own kind of brush with cancel culture. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that and how widespread a problem you think this is in your industry?
I've had a few brushes with cancel culture. Like I've had just this
how much
week.
Time we got?
Apparently, I'm a far right demagogue. So a couple of comedians have been trying to get me cancelled. Another right wing comedian's cancelled because they're all for tolerance and diversity, but not when it's diversity of political opinion. But so basically, in 2019, I took a show to the Perth Fringe. It was called Right Wing Comedian, and that got people's backs up in the comedy world, in the arts world. They dug through my tweets to find something to, you know, this archaeological excavations they do of tweets and go back to 2009 and then get Kevin Hart banned from hosting the Oscars. They did that to me. They just went back to that afternoon. I didn't have to go back very far. It was the last thing I tweeted. It was a bit of material from my show, and it was about male privilege. And I was saying, you know, people talk about male privilege, but I think it's hard being a man. I think that's why so many of us are transitioning right now. And then I did a bit about, basically the essence of the bit was how it's much harder. It would be much harder for me to transition as a 6'6" man than it would be for a woman to transition to being a man. Because you get like small feminine men, you don't get like 6'6", you know, hulking women. And it's men have to, males have to put in much more effort. And people condemned this as transphobic. But I actually wrote it, and they got my show pulled from my venue. I had to spend like thousands of dollars getting a new venue. It was a real mess. People complained it was transphobic. I don't think any transgender people actually complained. If they were, they hadn't made much effort. But, it was all people complaining on behalf, being offended by proxy, and got my show pulled. But I actually wrote the material with a transgender woman I was dating. So by pulling my show, assuming that it's, you know, it's the voice of, you know, an evil straight white man, they cancelled a rare transgender voice in comedy. So, you know, they're for wokists who, you know, say they want to uplift marginalized voices, they did the exact opposite. But yeah, it was really bad. And then, you know, I got a reputation as a problematic comedian, which didn't do many favors. I mean, it did, you know, the notoriety sort of helps a bit. I had comedians, bookers cancel me again because somebody in the industry said I was racist, like apropos of nothing, just based on the fact that I'd voted Tory in the past. That was enough for me to be a massive racist. And everybody backed her up because they were like, well, I thought you're for free speech. It's like, yeah, I'm for free speech for me, not for like idiots calling me racist on Twitter. But, and then just last week, in the wake of the Andrew Lawrence, thing. I don't know if you want to talk about Andrew Lawrence, but that was. I mean, he's been completely cancelled. His agents dropped him. His tour has been pulled. And this is a man with, you know, a family to feed. And the glee.
So we should probably explain a little bit. So Andrew Lawrence being a comedian, it was in the wake of the Euros final, made this joke about the white players scored, just saying type thing. Not quite that.
Yeah.
But, and as a result of this, it's also his kind of second cancellation, really, because he was kind of a bit of a canary in the coal mine for this. He had a Facebook post about, which made some comments about women on panel shows and which put him through the ringer a few years ago.
So a few years ago, he complained about women posing as comedians on panel shows, which people took to mean that he was saying women can't be comedians. And he wasn't. It was just, there was a lack of female comedians. So they'd get like just famous women and put them on panel shows. So you'd have like, you know, the Cheeky Girls or like, you know, somebody who presented the news on a comedy panel show. But it was just because there weren't enough female comedians. They had to make the quotas. So that was his point there. And with this joke, I mean, it was an unwise tweet. you know. But comedians are supposed to be unwise. It was unwise, but to see it as racist, you know, the essence, he was basically saying, oh, black people are bad at taking penalties. Now, we know that's factually not true. So we can assume that he's not being serious. And another clue that he's not being serious is the fact that he's a comedian. And comedians sometimes are joking. We're not, you know, whatever we say isn't to be taken at face value. But for some reason, when people get offended, it has to be taken at face value. I've never understood this. So I can understand, you know, some people were offended, were hurt by it, found it racist. I don't believe it was intended to be racist. I believe it was intended to be a comment on the hyper-racialization of sport and of the Euros in particular. Because woke people sort of latched on to the English football team because they were taking the knee and all the rest of it. Marcus Rashford's a great guy and he got the school dinners, forced the government to give people school dinners. So they latched onto it, they made it all about, and all we heard was, you know, race, race, race. And it's like, can't we just enjoy watching the football? It should have been a moment of national unity. Mm. But instead, you know, I mean, I didn't even realise when they took the penalties that, like, black guys didn't score and white guys, you know, I don't think anybody apart from woke people was watching to see which ethnicity they were. But as soon as the goals didn't go in, you know, there was woke people were kicking off saying there was all this, you know, barrage of racist abuse, and Andrew Lawrence seemed to take the flak for all of the racist abuse, even though the vast majority of the racist abuse came from outside the UK and a lot from Russian bots as well, who are trying to sow division in the UK, and it seems to be working pretty well.
And we'll come back to, I suppose, comedy particularly in a second, but I was wondering what you made, Chris, of that particular panic, because it went the post kind of Euros kind of discussion, and it dominated the news for a week. You know, it was the lead discussion in the House of Commons, and then naturally led to all kinds of discussions around censoring social media, all this kind of stuff. What did you make of all of that? Because it was a huge story. We've almost forgotten about it now.
You know? Well, that's the way, isn't it, with these things? But yeah, I think still it was possibly the biggest, most overblown moral panic I can remember. I mean, it was just insane. Like, you know how easy it is to set up a Twitter account, right?
I mean, and multiple Twitter accounts if you're that way inclined.
I hardly ever see any kind of racial abuse. I didn't see any of these racist tweets that led to this firestorm. Not even like in the news, they wouldn't report what these people had supposedly said or who they were. But, you know, this is a planet of, you know, 7 billion people. There are trolls out there. Whether they're Russian bots or what, it doesn't matter. There are attention-seeking trolls out there who are going to say offensive things for attention. It doesn't tell you anything about the state of the nation. But, you know, Newsnight and all the usual suspects, that's what they don't. Most of these people don't like football. That's the problem. So everyone's talking about football. They've got to find an angle that interests them. Race and, you know, Black Lives Matter and all that. Oh, we understand that. Let's talk about that. How can we insert that into the conversation? And then you had this bizarre situation in which the three players who missed, who, as you said, are all black, they suddenly became like heroes, right? They'd missed penalties, which traditionally means you get absolutely vilified. You know, David Beckham was like effigies of David Beckham hung in 98, not this kind of thing for getting sent off. Now, I'm not saying you should vilify the players, you know, who missed penalties. But glorifying them is even weirder. So like the official England FA Twitter feed put out a picture of the three of them, no one else, just those three, and said the three Lions, not Harry Kane and Harry Maguire who scored the penalties, or Jordan Pickford who saved them, just the three guys who missed. You know, because a tiny number of trolls were supposedly, you know, saying very unkind racist things about them. It's really bizarre, and how the whole thing got immediately turned into yet another stupid and tedious race story, rather than just a moment of, you know, national disappointment, which is what we normally get.
Yeah. Mm. It was bad enough as it was. I don't see why we had to get plunged into another race route, you know. But Leo, just to bring it back to comedy, one thing that's interesting is that you hear this discussion kind of within the comedy world, which is that, you know, people like you make this point about there's no diversity of opinion. There's, again, people are very unwilling to book or work with comedians who are seen as not even just right wing, but I guess kind of anti-woke, a bit against the grain, you know, not just your standard Radio 4 type routine. Hmm. But some people say, well, there just aren't that many right-wing comedians, you know, in the same way that, you know, trying to get find enough to get women on panel shows a few years ago. You know, it's just you, yourself, Jeff Norcott.
Well, there's no, you know, a few there's others. No real, I mean, there's not BBC. I mean, I've been, I had a BBC slot on Michal's BBC Radio 5 live show, and it was great, 150 quid a month. And I was cancelled from that for being, basically for being right-wing and being politicised. So it's not that, you know, they've got all these slots and they're desperate to fill them, because if they were, there would suddenly be loads of right-wing comedians. You know what I mean? Like, comedians are the most right-wing people in the world. They're like, they're self-starting Thatcherite entrepreneurs going out and hustling for work in a free market. And none of them pay their full taxes, because they all get paid in cash. It goes in a sock. And you know, so it's all for show. It's all very performative. So many comedians are left wing because it's very expedient. It helps you, you know, with your career and helps you fit in with the comedy community. But also because it's a shortcut to sort of being, the most important thing in comedy is to be likable, rather than, you know, you can't laugh at somebody you don't like. So being likable is actually more important than being funny. So if they go on stage and they say, "Oh, guys, we should share the wealth and, you know, feed all the, you know," it's just a shortcut. You know, saying you're left wing, saying you're a left wing socialist is a shortcut to appearing nice and being likable.
I guess, how optimistic are you about things at the moment? Because there was a bit of a pushback. You know, obviously you were involved with Comedy Unleashed. There's also people like yourself, like Jeff Norcott, people like this who are starting to cut through and get those slots and all the rest of it. Do you think that things are looking up because people just have had enough of people just getting up and saying the same Daily Mail punchlines over and over again, that they do want to hear something a little bit different?
Yeah, from the audience point of view, the audience are desperate. They're thirsty for something that's just not somebody coming out and be like, "Oh, people who voted for Brexit are idiots." You know what I mean? Like, which is, you know, that's an entire, you know, that's Nish Kumar's entire oeuvre. You know what I mean? Can be boiled down to that. Boris Johnson's a racist and Brexit is for idiots. And I feel happy slagging Nish Kumar off, because he slagged me off on stage. And so that's what you get, Nish. But yeah, from the audience side, it's very positive. There's a lot of demand there for sort of heterodox, non-lefty, non-woke comedy. But from the industry side, oh my God, I mean, the sort of glee with which all the comedians rounded on Andrew Lawrence like rabid dogs, like wolves, you know, tearing apart a carcass, was disgusting to watch.
Leo, have you got anything coming up that you want to promote? Where can people find out about any upcoming shows you might have, all the rest of it?
So you can see my live shows, all my live dates on my website. I'm doing the Edinburgh Festival, so I'm doing a new show called Cancel Culture, and I also run a free speech improvised show called Hate and Live, where comedians hate on audience suggestions, so, you know, anything goes. It's really fun. But yeah, my YouTube channel is doing really well. I should really knuckle down and put more videos out, but it's doing well anyway. So please follow me on YouTube.
Excellent. Chris, Leo, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thanks, Tom.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.